very big one by a man named Dermot McCulloch, which is about 800 pages. But there is this one that's just come out, published by Erdmans, by Leslie Williams, Emblem of Faith Untouched, A Short Life of Thomas Cranmer. Emblem of Faith Untouched, A Short Life of Thomas Cranmer. It's really very, very good. Goes through the essentials of his life and something of the, obviously, the Christian theological motivation for what he did. Well, as was mentioned there, let me turn from the 16th century to the 17th century. I think it's necessary to give a bit of background. This is the period of the Puritans, and probably one of the most maligned groups in the history of the church are the Puritans, and not simply from the external world, secular academy to some degree, but also by Christians themselves. And I suspect that if I said to you, a good illustration of this, the failure to understand who the Puritans were, if I said to you, you know, I really think you're kind of puritanical, almost definitely you would not hear that as a compliment. You'd hear that as you're rigid, you're legalistic, you're a killjoy, etc., etc. And that term is, I think, indicative of the way in which the government who comes in at the end of the 17th century, which we're going to look at, the government of Charles II, who was determined to destroy Puritanism as a political force, but especially also as a theological force, to some degree succeeded. And part of that, his campaign against Puritanism, was language and the use of language. And there was enormous amount of propaganda put out against the Puritans as sour, killjoys, revolutionaries bent on overthrowing society, determined to rob all men and women of any sort of pleasure. And the reality is quite, quite different, as we will touch on a little bit, and then think about Baptist experience, who are Puritans, during the years, particularly the 1660 to 1688. When Mary II succumbed to ovarian cancer in 1558, she was succeeded by a Protestant queen, who we know as Elizabeth I. Elizabeth I really is a remarkable queen in many respects. From a political point of view, it is she who begins to build Britain as a significant power on the European continent. It's during her reign, we call it the Elizabethan Age, that you get a flowering of English literature, probably the most prominent figure being William Shakespeare, of which there have been and still are significant debates about his theological perspectives. One of the things that I think has been wrong in the study of Shakespeare, I'm sure all of you took Shakespeare at some point in high school, remembering my own high school experience, we took a Shakespeare play every year, and they went from the comedies, Midsummer Night's Dream in grade 9, and then Romeo and Juliet, Julius Caesar, and by the time you finished, you were into the tragedies, King Lear or Macbeth or Hamlet. And I think rightly so that we need to be exposed to Shakespeare. He was a master of the English language. So much of our English language comes from him. What has been wrongly, Shakespeare has been wrongly treated in one sense, is the way in which religious themes and theological themes permeate quite a number of his plays. And take, for instance, Measure for Measure, which is a comedy, but it's not so much a comedy. And it's really a study of that statement of Jesus that as you have judged, so you shall be judged. With what measure you have been given out, by that you will be measured. And it's really a kind of a study of that. But it's the Elizabethan age is an age of the flowering of English literature. It's a flowering of the English Navy, which would eventually come to be the dominant political force in the 19th century. You know, rule Britannia. Britannia rules the waves. Those are the sorts of things I grew up with. I lived in a world in which my teachers in the late 50s, early 60s, were people who had been taught by Victorians who still thought the British Empire was the most powerful empire in the world, and it was a pipe dream, but we used to get, I can still remember it being, they would bring out this map of the world, and you had this little island cluster, a cluster of islands that were pink. Not sure why pink, but anyway. And then you'd see everything else that was pink was Britain, and you had this Canada and Australia and New Zealand and South Africa, etc. And but that world was completely gone, and as I said, it was a bit of a pipe dream. But Elizabeth is the figure who sets that on providentially. By the way, all of this is tied up with the purposes of God, because in the providence of God, it would be the English-speaking people who would become at the heart of the translation of the scriptures and then the propagation of the scriptures by missions. In the 19th century, the global missionary movement, its heart is England. That doesn't mean the English are always the most faithful missionaries, but there is this great concern to take the gospel to the ends of the earth. And America inherited that in the 20th century. America still is the most largest sending missionary sending nation in the world. Whether that'll be true at the end of the century, I suspect not. South Korea is rapidly gaining. But in the providence of God, and it is providential, it says it has got nothing to do with English-speaking peoples as an ethnic group. It's got to do with the fact that there were so many in those cultures on both sides of the Atlantic who loved the gospel. And God has blessed those peoples remarkably, which means the turning away from the gospel, which has happened in the British Isles largely, except for certain areas, maybe Northern Ireland, which is about 25% evangelical, or the Scottish Highlands, which would be about the same. And the turning away from the gospel that we see here in America is the Lord's statement onto Capernaum is, "Woe unto you, it'll be worse for you in the judgment than for Sodom and Gomorrah." Because the Lord Jesus was there, they had the light of the gospel, and to abandon that light is horrifying. And so Elizabeth I really kind of sets the foundations. She is an evangelical. She is a Protestant. She is a Calvinist. But she has a major problem with a group of people called the Puritans. The first time the word Puritan is used in the English language is 1563, and it probably means the idea of purify. And the Puritans wanted worship to be according to the scriptures. Here they differed from Elizabeth and many of Elizabeth's bishops. And the bishops in the Church of England at the time, if it was not forbidden in the Word of God, we could do it. The Puritan perspective, if it is not commanded in the Word of God, we should not do it. God has laid out in His Word how we should worship Him. We can't use a variety of other things. And so there were quarrels about worship. There were quarrels about church government. The Puritans soon came to the conviction, and I think rightly so, that within the church, within the scriptures, there is no such thing as episcopal church government. Bishops who then appoint pastors over churches. That just can't be found and proven in the scriptures. The college I went to, Wycliffe College, was an Anglican college. It was very interesting in their statement of faith. They mentioned that episcopacy was an early Christian model. They don't say scriptural. And that's because these men were far too evangelical to know that the Episcopal Church government, as it develops in the history of the church, could be proven from Holy Scripture. The two basic models that can be proven from Holy Scripture, and there's been long debates about which one is right, is Presbyterian and Congregationalist. And then we've had mixtures in between where you have a Congregationalist model with elder-led and elder-rule and whatever. We're not going to get into all of that. But the Puritans were Presbyterian, by and large, early Puritans. They're a very small group of them. Once you open the door to talking about church government, it's not surprising some of them became Congregationalist. During the reign of Elizabeth, she sought to suppress Puritanism. Her successor was King James I, Scottish king, her cousin. He became king in 1603, died in 1625. And he was raised Presbyterian. He hated Presbyterianism. He loathed it. Because to run Scotland, he had to deal with around 3,000 Presbyterian elders. It was much easier to run the Church of England where you've got 20 bishops, you put them in, you can get them in, you can get them easily in the, just this side of the church, and he tells them all what he wants them to do, and things get done. Not surprisingly, again, the Puritans are active during his reign, trying to reform the church. His son, Charles II, a very different man, a very devoted father, a very good husband, absolutely lousy as a king, finds himself in major quarrels with the Puritans and begins to persecute them. It's during the reign in the 1630s that, late 1620s, 1630s, you should know this from American history. I'm assuming American history is still taught to some degree. Actually, that I know is a challenge. I was just reading something just last night about the teaching of American history in our schools here, and the inability of people to know anything about the Constitution, who the role, say, of James Hamilton and Madison and so on. So I shouldn't assume that you know, but anyway, the beginning of emigration of the Puritans to New England is in the 1620s. They want a place of religious liberty, and they cannot find it in England. And that accelerates in the 1630s. In 1638, the war breaks out. It's the beginning of the British Civil Wars. That war will last from 1638 to 1651. Forgive all the history. It's important to see the background. It's a period of war. Civil War is the worst of all wars. The American Civil War is still shaping America to some degree. It's still a living memory, interestingly enough. I met a brother in Louisiana about 10 years ago. He was an elder in Church Jerry Marcelino, if some of you know Pastor Marcelino's church in Laurel, Mississippi. And we got talking about the American Civil War, which I have some interest in, and he mentioned to me that is, you know, he's in his heart, he's still got problems with those Yankees because of what they did to his grandfather. So, like, this is now 2006, and the American Civil War ended in 1865. So I'm thinking, is your grandfather, like, what are you talking about? Well, he says, you need to know, my grandfather was 14 at the beginning of the war in 1861. He joined up. He fought at the Battle of Antietam in 1862, was captured, spent the next 3 years in a Union prison in Illinois, and at the end of the war had to walk home without any shoes to Texas. And it was only Christians along the way who helped him. He didn't marry until about 1895. And when he was around in his 60s, he married an 18-year-old. They had a child. That child didn't marry until 1950, until he was in his 50s, and this guy was his son. So this was his grandfather. It was absolutely incredible. And it was still a living, very living memory for him. And he was a Christian, but he said, I've got problems dealing with Yankees. And Civil War is, of all types of wars, the worst. You know, we fought a very bitter war with the Germans and the Japanese during the Second World War. Well, I mean, maybe there are some who still remember that with, you know, deep hatred for them. But we've gotten over that, I suspect, largely. Germany and Japan are now key allies. But Civil War, the wounds that Civil War makes go deep. And the British Civil Wars were deep, deep wounds. And those who fought against the king, namely the Puritans, they were never forgiven. And among the Puritans were Baptists. Now, there's a lot of debate. We can't go through all this. There's a lot of debate about where do Baptists come from. The roots of Baptists are the Puritans. The Puritans were very concerned about church government, very concerned about finding in Holy Scripture a blueprint on how to do church. I don't think the New Testament gives us an exact blueprint of how to do church government. I think there's a flexibility there. Our Baptist forebears would not have agreed with that. They believed that there was a blueprint. They had to find it. And who we are as Baptists is deeply explained from our Puritan roots. Our roots are Puritanism. And during the 1640s, 1650s, it was a time of war and religious revival. Amazing revival. In England, in 1644, there were only seven Calvinistic Baptist churches. They were all in London in 1644. The next 7 or 8 years are war. Then the government of Oliver Cromwell. They actually take the king, execute him. Horrifying to many in Britain. They execute him on charges of treason in 1649. And the British have a republic. The American Republic is not the first time English-speaking peoples have wanted a republican experiment. And during the 1660s, Baptists are significant power players in the British Isles. There is remarkable religious freedom, remarkable toleration. The challenges that come with that are all kinds of weird groups emerging. People like some that nobody knows about today, the Muggletonians. John Muggleton and his cousin, Ludovic Muggleton and his cousin John Reeve announced that they were the two witnesses in Revelation. And just a bizarre group. The last Muggletonian that we know of died in 1960. He had in his attic about 500 Muggletonian books written from the 1600s. Absolutely treasure trove of weird eschatology and weird stuff, but it's for historians, it was a fabulous find. Probably the weirdest group, you know this group, who emerged at the time, were the Quakers. And nobody viewed the Quakers as this kind, gentle, pacifist group who didn't cause anybody harm. They were real troublemakers, but again, we won't go into all that detail. And in the middle of this, the Baptists flourish. In 1644, there are seven. In 1660, there are 130 Baptist churches in the British Isles. They have enormous success and blessing in church planting, in evangelization, etc. And some of those churches are upwards of 2,000-3,000 people. When John Bunyan would come to London to preach on a weekday morning, he could expect 1,200-1,500 people to come and hear him. On a Sunday morning, maybe 3,000 would come and hear Bunyan preach. Oliver Cromwell died in 1658, and then things begin to collapse. A number of the army generals who had fought with Cromwell begin to take over sections of Britain, and really anarchy seems to be the rule of the day. And the reality is this, like it or not, that it is better to have tyranny than anarchy. And you might not agree, but with anarchy, well, if you want to see anarchy, it's Syria. It's just completely anarchic. And so the generals who had fought with Cromwell decide to invite back the king. His name is Charles II, and he will be king from 1660 to 1685. Now, Charles is very different from his father. He is not a good family man, but he's a very good politician. His father was a lousy politician, but a great family man. And Charles was married. He had a number of mistresses. He never has a legitimate heir, and when he is invited back, the Puritans meet him on the continent. They go to Holland at a place called Breda and ask him two things. Number one, what do you think of the Holy Scriptures? Well, I love this book more than any other book in the world, he said, which probably was a lie. The second one was, will you guarantee religious freedom? Of course I will. Everybody will be allowed to worship according to their conscience. It's not clear whether he meant that or not. Certainly when he gets back into England, the men who come to power with him are determined on one thing, that the Puritans, what they did to England, will never, ever happen again. And they begin to pass a series of legislation. It's known collectively as the Clarendon Code. And it begins to be passed in 1661. It'll go to 1673. And what it essentially, I'm going to spell out a little bit, What it essentially means is that if you're a Baptist, if you're a Puritan, you'll be a second-class citizen from that point on. This will persist for 200 years. To be an upstanding member of society, you had to be Anglican. The persecution that will go on in the 17th century and then in the 18th century that we'll look at, it's important to remember these for a variety of reasons, one of which is this, is that it's easy to think about persecution and martyrdom in terms of the violence that we've already just looked at with Thomas Cranmer, where gospel people are killed. My suspicion, and that is happening in parts of the world, you know that. It's happening in Muslim countries. It's happening in some of the kind of holdout communist countries, etc. But the sort of persecution that we've experienced, and you might think, what's he talking about? Well, I'm talking about 2 Timothy 3:12. Anyone who desires to live godly in Christ Jesus will suffer persecution. Has been of a much milder but more maybe dangerous variety in some respects. It's little things. It's ostracism. It's name-calling and so on. My suspicion is this will get worse unless God brings revival, that it'll be increasingly difficult in the public sphere to speak evangelical perspectives, that laws will be put in place. I think we already see it. I think the rapid movement within 25 years of the acceptance of lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, queer, that's that acronym, in our culture by people we would never have thought would have embraced this stuff. The sort of rubbish about, California is talking about refusing to recommend as tourist sites states that don't ensure, transgender bathrooms. The sort of lawsuits that we probably will experience. I read something in the, I think it was the Wall Street Journal. It might have been a letter to the editor, which is very unusual because the Wall Street Journal tends to be a great paper in many respects, saying, if Christian churches have problems with these things, we should stop giving them money and stop giving them tax credit and relief. And so this sort of thing, my suspicion is this will become rapidly part of our world. And that's the world of the 18th century, and that's why it's very important to study that. The 17th century is moving towards that. It's moving away from the violence and the more the laws that restrict. The Clarendon Code consisted of a number of acts. For instance, there was the Act of Uniformity. And the Act of Uniformity was issued on August the 24th, 1662, St. Bartholomew's Day. Not the best day to issue an act, because 90 years earlier, on St. Bartholomew's Day, there had been a horrific massacre of evangelicals in France. It's known as the St. Bartholomew's Day Massacre, in which the Queen of France, Catherine de' Medici, the Queen Mother, on probably the subtle hints from the papacy, launched a vicious attack on Christians in France, in which somewhere around 30,000 within 2 weeks were butchered. Men and women pulled out of their homes. Sort of thing we saw in Rwanda and with the Hutu and Tutsi, that was going on. And on that fateful day, an act was issued in England called the Act of Uniformity, which specified this, that anybody leading worship had to use the Book of Common Prayer. Here is Thomas Cranmer's, I think, great achievement in terms of a spiritual classic now being used as a religious sledgehammer. If you do not use that book, every jot and tittle, when you're leading worship, you have to pray every prayer that is specified there. You can't change any of the wording. Then if you can't agree that you will do that, you have to leave the ministry. And in the space of one day, 2,000 ministers in England were kicked out. There are only 5,000 parish churches. That meant that nearly one-third of them no longer had a minister. And how on earth are you going to find ministers. And not surprisingly, this will cause a massive moral decline. That's one aspect of it. Or there was what was called the Five-Mile Act. The Five-Mile Act was that a minister who refused to go along with the Act of Uniformity could not live within 5 miles of a town. Now, you might think, 5 miles, that's no big deal. What they're trying to do is prevent the man gather a congregation. They're basically being shunted out into the country. If you were to do something today, it'd be similar today. A minister who refuses to go along with the way we do worship could not live within 300 miles of a town, maybe. It's going to make it. Most ministers didn't have horses. Now, to own a horse, you have to have a significant amount of wealth. You have to have not only the upkeep of the horse, you have to have an acre of land. And generally speaking, horses are social creatures, and that meant you have to have more than one horse, which means you have 2 acres of land, at least, at a minimum. And so it was a way of trying to prevent these men gathering congregations. A third law, two other laws, the Corporation Act, the Test Act. If you could not prove you'd taken the Lord's Supper, this is a travesty, the politicizing the Lord's table. If you could not prove you'd taken the Lord's Supper within the previous year, you could not become an officer in the Army or Navy. And if you could not prove you've taken the Lord's Supper within the previous year, you could not graduate from Oxford or Cambridge, only 2 universities. Well, what are they designed to do? They are designed to prevent the Puritans ever having access to any political power. It's also designed to prevent the Puritans from getting higher education. In other words, we're going to destroy the political power base, the educational power base of these people. Other laws were pettier. There was the other major law was the Conventicle Act. The Conventicle Act was if you were discovered at the age over the age of 15 meeting with more than 5 other adults for religious purposes without an Anglican minister, you'd be fined. It was illegal for you to meet in any way, shape, or form for religious purposes with more than 5 people over the age of 15. Unless an Anglican minister were present. The first time you were caught, you'd be fined a certain amount. Second time, it'd be a higher fine. Third time, you'd be imprisoned. If you did that a second group of times, you'd be fined again, then imprisoned. At that point, you'd be given a choice of exile or a massive term imprisonment. The other acts were pettier. Only Anglican ministers could marry you. So let's say, well, this is a Baptistic fellowship. I don't know where your closest Anglican church is or Episcopalian church. That means that everybody being married in this church, for the marriage to be legitimate, had to go down and get him to marry you. If he doesn't like Baptists, he won't marry you. So then you have to go to the next village. And people don't travel in this period of time. If you go to Penn Station on Monday morning, let's say you go to Penn Station next Monday morning, it's not a holiday, and you stand there for 1 hour, you will see more people in 1 hour than virtually everybody in the 18th century saw in their entire life. George Whitefield, who's the great, in the 17th century and 18th century, George Whitefield is the great evangelist. I mean, he's the complete exception. Most people traveled within 20 miles of where they grew up. My mother's family, my mother grew up in just outside of Dublin, Bray. Most of her family still live within like 10 miles of where they were born. And they've always lived there. And that's just the way people lived. There's no way of getting around. You don't have cars. You don't have trains. Trains are not invented until the 1820s. The train changes. It enables the common person to have holidays. Nobody had holidays before the 1820s. And you don't have horses, so you just stay where you are. And so that's the Marriage Act. Now, probably the most onerous one was the Burial Act. Let's say you lived in a village, and there's only the Anglican church. Every Anglican church had a village church. Not every church, obviously, would have a Baptist church. You lived in the village, and let's say your mother died, and you need to get her buried. Where are you going to bury her? Are you going to bury her in the cemetery that belongs to the Anglican Church? The minister doesn't like Baptists. He'll basically tell you, you can't bury her here. Because every Anglican cemetery is consecrated holy ground. And unless you've got a consecrated Anglican, you're going to pollute the cemetery. In London, big metropolis, the Baptists built their own cemetery along with Congregationalists. It's known as Bunhill Fields. Pastor Van Cort was mentioning he was there. Was it this year?
Last year.
Yeah, I mean, pretty well every year when I go to London, if I can, we go to Bunhill Fields. At its height, there were around 100,000 Baptists and Congregationalists buried there. John Bunyan's buried there. John Gill, John Rippon, John Owen. I mean, it's just a remarkable place. That's London. London's 500,000 people, largest city in the world at the time. Most villages didn't have that. This was a real problem. One time, Baptists were so frustrated by this. Somebody had died in the family. The local minister refused to allow them to be buried in the local church. So what they did was they went and dug a hole in the middle of the main street and buried the person right in the middle of the hole in the main street. And it was a protest. I mean, I'm not sure I would agree with that, you know, making a burial a protest movement, but you can imagine. These things are petty. But what they're doing is driving home. Look, if you want to be a full member of English society, you become an Anglican. If you're not, you're an outsider. And we really don't want you here. Between 1660 and 1688, there was vicious persecution. Pretty well every Baptist minister, there's only one that I know that was not, but pretty well every Baptist minister was arrested. So obviously Pastor Van Cort, I assume you have elders here, all of you would have been in prison. If this is 1660 to 1688, all of you would have been in prison for a period of time. John Bunyan was there for 12 years. That's a very lengthy. Prison is not what prison, well, prison has always been brutal, but it was even more brutal then. The prison, normal prison cell would be maybe a sixth of the size of this room, maybe this area here. 10 men in there, no furniture, and a hole in the ground for necessities. If your family doesn't bring you food, you'll die. And for many Baptist ministers, it's a death sentence. Baptists are resort. How do they worship? Well, they can't meet in buildings. They often have to go in the open air. There's a great statement of Broadmeat Baptist Church around 1668. It talks about how they met in December in the fields, and they said there was a hard frost that day, and there was snow on the ground, but the sun was shining, and we were at peace. And you can imagine then having to go out into fields and into woods to worship. Often what Baptists would do is they put, this is true of Presbyterians and Congregationalists, but we're just talking about Baptists. Baptists would put people up in trees as lookouts in case constables were coming to arrest them. And we've got some great stories of the people in the trees yelling and the Baptists having to scatter. In one case, they were very wise. What they did was they met on the county line of three counties. So if they saw the police coming from one, they just simply stepped over the line. And I don't know why the police never got there, the constables never got their act together, and all three counties converged on them. I can actually take you to that very spot. It's at the intersection of Wiltshire, Dorset, and Somerset. And there is now a Baptist church there that grew out of that witness. In London, things were easier. In villages and towns, it was difficult. The great thing about villages and towns is the sense of community. Think about it. Most people have never traveled more than 20 miles. They live their whole life in this world. Their parents were there, their grandparents. You know everybody in the town. There's a sense of community. There's a negative sense of that. Everybody knows what everybody else is up to. And if you don't come to parish church, they know that. What are you doing going off in the woods on Sunday morning? What are you doing out there? And so these things would be known. London's very different. London's a huge metropolis, 500,000 people. A lot of Puritans and Baptists went there because you could be anonymous. And what Baptists would do is they'd buy a row of buildings, a row of houses, a lot of row housing. My earliest memories, I grew up in Birmingham in England, is living on a row house, a series of row houses. You know, all these houses joined together with adjoining walls. And they'd buy a number of row houses, and they'd knock out all of the nun load-bearing walls and create a large open space with what they would use as a church. You would gather on a Sunday morning. It might take you 6 to 8 hours to gather. You can't all emerge at once, come down at once. The authorities would know. And so you'd come in twos and threes. And after the whole congregation is gathered, maybe around midday, you'd have worship. No singing. If you sing, you'll be heard. So the reading of the Psalms, there'd be prayer, scripture reading, and then preaching. In the preaching, what you would have is you'd have a platform at the one end of the room with about a dozen of the elders sitting on it. And then there was a brother, because there were spies in the congregation. There was an infamous gang during the 1660s through the 1680s known as the Hilton Gang. And you can give some idea of what the authorities were up to. Here is the Church of England bishops paying money to an infamous gang who were into smuggling, all kinds of nefarious activities. And one of the nefarious activities they were into was infiltrating Baptist churches and taking notes of the leaders of the churches, and then seeking prosecution. And if a prosecution stuck, they'd normally seize your property, and the Hilton Gang would get a cut of it. And so what the Baptists would do is they'd have a brother. He had a very important role. When the preaching began, he was to draw the curtain in front of all the elders on the platform. And then one of them would stand and preach. And if you weren't there every week, you wouldn't know who it was. You wouldn't know the voice. And then at the end, he would, once they'd all sat down, he would draw the curtain again. He had to wait till they all sat down. On one occasion, we're told it was Andrew Gifford. He pulled the curtain too soon, and Gifford was seen. And in fact, the Hilton Gang, these people were bold enough to try to arrest him on the spot. Now, what the Baptists had also done is they'd built a trap door in the middle of the platform. So if that happened, it was an expedient. If it happened, they could open the trap door. He could get down and get away. And they had grabbed him. He wiggled out of his jacket. You can imagine, this is a worship service. Wiggled out of his jacket and got down the trap door and got away. But they'd seen his face. And so posters went up around the city. We're looking for this man. So next time he came in to preach, he had to come in disguise. So he disguised himself a variety of ways. Sometimes he dressed up as a British army officer, which no Baptist could be, so they figured, well, he's an army officer. I've read one account. I couldn't find it. I was looking for it for today, where he dresses himself actually up as a woman and to get into the city. Because the city was a walled city, and it would have gates where they could examine people coming in and so on. And once he got in, he discarded his women's clothing and went and preached. So, I mean, these are all expediencies that we forget long about. But let me talk quickly in the time that remaining about three men. The man that you often would think about, as I said, is John Bunyan. Bunyan was in prison from 1660 to 1672. But I want to talk about three other men who we need to remember. Abraham Cheer, C-H-E-A-R-E. Abraham Cheer, C-H-E-A-R-E. He was born in 1626. We know virtually nothing about his young years. He would die in 1668. He died in prison. He pastored a congregation in a place called Plymouth. Plymouth is very important for Americans because the first Puritans who came over to Massachusetts left from Plymouth. If you ever go to Plymouth, I've actually seen it. There's a whole plaque there that was dedicated, I forget, by one of the American presidents who went over to Britain, and he has dedicated a plaque to the first Pilgrim fathers and mothers who came over because they sailed from Plymouth. You can actually see the plaque. You see the harbor where they sailed from. He was the minister there of a Baptist church from the late 1640s, we don't know exactly when he was called, to 1668, so about 20 years. His early years are obscure. There is some indication that his father was a miller, rented a number of mills to mill flour and so on, but again, that's not clear. During the 1640s, 1650s, he managed to avoid being involved in any of the army fighting. He was there during the siege of Plymouth. The king's army besieged Plymouth for about a year, failed to take the city, so he would have known something of the horrors of war, but he was not actually in the army. Around 1648 is when he's called to be the pastor of the church, and he has a very important pastorate during the 1650s. He helps to establish the church on a solidly biblical reform foundation, and also to begin to evangelize into neighboring counties. There's a great story of him being invited to baptize a man who was in Oliver Cromwell's army. He was a colonel in 1655 or so, and it was January. And this guy writes to Cheer and says, "I'd like you to come down and baptize me as a believer." And so Cheer was quite happy to go down there. When he gets down there, there's frost on the ground, and he finds the guy has advanced stages of consumption, or TB, and looks like he's dying. And so the guy tells him, he says, I think the Lord wants me to be baptized as a believer. But he said, obviously you see I'm ill. But he says, I think that when I get baptized, the Lord will heal me. Would you baptize me? And Cheer writes all this down, and Cheer says, "Well, I really don't think that's wise. Why don't we have a weekend of fasting and prayer with the church, and then we'll discuss it on Monday?" And they do that. And on Monday, they take it's a Congregationalist church. This is very interesting. They take a poll of the church, and how many of you think I should baptize our brother, and it'll be God will heal him? Well, about a third of the congregation said, "Yes, Pastor Cheer, you need to go ahead. Baptize him, and that'll be a sign that believer's baptism by immersion is God's way of baptism, and God will heal him." About a third of the congregation said, "Well, you'd need to do it anyway, because that's the biblical way of baptism. We don't think it's going to help him. In fact, he might die as a result of it, but you need to go ahead and do it." And about a third of the church said, "No, Pastor Cheer, we think it's testing God." And Cheer says, "Well, I'm inclined to your persuasion." What's very interesting is nobody came up with the idea, why don't we just sprinkle a few drops of water on his head? I find that intriguing. Baptism is by immersion. And so the day came. It was about 2 days later. It was a Monday or a Tuesday. And there were two other women to be baptized. They were baptizing them in a river. It was down at the bottom of the hill. And so the two women come down, Cheer baptizes them. And then to his consternation, he sees somebody bringing this colonel down on a horse. They're holding him. He looks like he's nigh unto death. He hasn't slept hardly for a week. He hasn't eaten much. They bring him down, and he looks at Cheer, and he says to him, "Brother, will you baptize me, and do you believe God will heal me?" And Cheer says, this is to Cheer's credit. He writes this account up. He says, "No, I do not think God's going to heal you." Then he turned to a deacon. I forget the deacon's name. He says, "Brother, do you believe that if you baptize me, God will heal you?" The guy says, "Yes, I do." So they get him off the horse. They baptize him. This is a true story. He comes up out of the water, jumps up out of the water, runs up the hill. This is the guy who could hardly get down, nigh unto death, goes home, has a roast beef dinner, sleeps for 8 hours, and is healed. And Cheer just can't believe it. It's just remarkable. Anyways, you've got a man of, I think, real gospel fidelity in the sense of, he had real problems with this, and he truthfully gives the account, which doesn't reflect well on him in one sense, but I can certainly sympathize with him. I think I'd be in the same kind of boat. In 1661, he's arrested for preaching the gospel. And the prison he's put in is one writer who knew the prison said it is a living tomb, a sink of filth and profanity. Usually the people in the prison were prostitutes and thieves. And he's stuck in there with in that context, just a vile context, and both spiritually and physically. Now, for somebody like Cheer, for a lot of these Baptists, they'd normally not get to meet prostitutes and thieves. So it's a great place. These people can't get out, so they're going to start to share the gospel with them. And some of them are, in time, converted. He's there for a number of weeks, finally released. Fong year, 1662, he's arrested again. This is when the Act of Uniformity was passed. And he spends about a year or so in prison. He's arrested again in 1665. Each time they let him out, they say, "Will you promise not to preach again?" "Well, no, I can't make that promise." And he's arrested again in 1668, and he would die in prison in 1668. During his time in prison, this is very important. You may not have read any much Puritan literature. You need to. One of the great riches of the Christian heritage are the Puritan writings. And most of those men wrote those writings. The ones that are the richest are after 1660, most of them. When Puritan ministers were refused to allow to preach, many of them were shut up in prison. So what did they do? They wrote books. And Cheer wrote a great book called Words in Season. It was published after his death. And here's a number of things in there which kind of give you his perspective on persecution. In one letter he wrote September 17th, he says this: "These holes of the earth where violence has thrust us in, as in so many slaughterhouses, they have become for me the presence chamber of the great king, where he has brought me, and he feasts me with his fat things." I can't imagine. I mean, these are really hell holes. They're hellish from any standpoint. Filthy, vile, smelly. In the summer, brutal in terms of the heat that would be there. In the winter, damp and cold. Snow doesn't come normally in the southern part of England, so they wouldn't have had these sort of icy conditions. But horrible places. But they are, notice he says, presence chambers of the great king. John Bunyan, I'm not going to talk, as I said, about Bunyan primarily. Bunyan says on one occasion, he said, "This prison has become the perfuming room where God is preparing me for his presence." And he's thinking of the story of Esther, when Esther was for a year being made ready for the presence of the king. On another occasion, Cheer says this. He's encouraging. Most of the letters are written to his members of his flock. For many of them, it will be discouraging to see their pastor imprisoned. For some of them, it might even cause them to question their biblical convictions. And so what he does is he tries to encourage them. If you end up here, this is what you must do. He said on one occasion to them how to prepare yourself for persecution. "It is vital to get your heart established in grace. You need to grow into a substantial experiential communion with Jesus Christ." In other words, if you don't have that ongoing walk of grace with the Lord that is drawing richly from his word, and is not only theologically impacting your mind, but also experientially challenging and impacting your heart, you will not be able to last in a place like this. Again, Cheer, a friend had just been arrested. He said to him, "You now have an opportunity to exalt Jesus Christ in suffering for his name's sake." On another occasion, this is not long before his death, he's recognizing that some Christians have fallen away in this context. He says this, and he's not boasting, "I have never yet seen the least reason, praise Christ my Lord, or one hour's temptation to relinquish or repent of my testimony, to any one persecuted truth of Christ for which I suffer. And what Cheer found was that imprisonment may have shut him up in one sense. It gave him an access in the writing, but it also crystallized his faith. It refined his faith. And he realized that what he had said when he was at large about the preciousness of the gospel and the preciousness of Christ was driven home to him in prison. He died in 1668 during his final imprisonment. Second example, Andrew Gifford. I've already mentioned him. Gifford was born in 1649. He died in 1721. Gifford had a very famous grandson, also called Andrew Gifford, and sometimes the two are confused. Andrew Gifford was one of the, this is another story, but one of the few Baptist ministers who stood with George Whitefield. Many Baptists were, many Calvinistic Baptists had problems with Whitefield because he said he was a Calvinist, but when he preached, he sure sounded like an Arminian, pleading with sinners to come to Christ. Part of the problem in the 18th century is what we call hyper-Calvinism. Andrew Gifford was one of the few men who would stand on the pulpit with Whitefield. That's his grandson. And very well known in his day, but I'm talking about his grandfather. His grandfather had a long ministry in a place called Bristol at the Pithay Baptist Church, P-I-T-H-A-Y. He was there for 60 years. That sounds enormously long. This is an age, it's not until the 19th century, probably the 1850s, that ministers start to move churches quickly. So you get ministers, you know, starting in, I can think of one minister, a man named T.T. Shields, very well known in the 20th century. I mean, the first five pastorates he was in, he went through in about 12 years. He was in one church 2 years, another church 3 years. That's not good for the church. These men would be there for long periods of time. He was an intrepid evangelist. When Bristol was shut off, they couldn't meet in Bristol. He would go outside, meet at a place called Kingswood. Any of you know the story of George Whitefield? You'll know that Kingswood was where he first began open-air preaching. The only time I've ever been to the spot where George Whitefield in 1737 publicly open-air preached the first time, there's a plaque there that says, it's in the middle of a housing survey now. It's interesting. You've got this housing survey, and in the middle you've got this pulpit, which has a plaque on it, which says George Whitefield preached here. But there's another plaque that said in the 1680s, Baptists from Bristol would come out and preach. Well, that was Andrew Gifford. And Gifford would come out there and preach. In that time, it was Woods. He's the man who dressed up in a variety of costumes to get into Bristol and London to preach. He was imprisoned a number of occasions. He did get caught. One of them is, I'm going to read two letters. One is two accounts. One is a dream. And please note, I'm not, I had the healing thing and now a dream. These are unusual. And I'm not trying to promote anything by them. In 1660, he on a particular Saturday night, his wife had a dream. And the account runs like this. His wife dreamed that her husband arose to go out preaching according to an appointment. But upon opening the door of their home, the very first step he took was up to his knees in snow. It was the winter. Thereupon she dissuaded him, this is all in the dream, but in vain, that he went and was seized by two constables, whose names she mentioned. She knew who they were in the dream. And he was brought to the Sun Tavern, and he was there confined in a dining room, placed behind a particular table in the dining room, and one of them by force held him down by leaning on his right shoulder and the other on his left. It made such an impression on him, she awaked with fright and told him of it, and all the while did seek to persuade him. But he told her that he had to go, that nothing could hinder him from his master's business. They arose. Upon opening the door of their front door, they found there had fallen a great snow since he had gone to bed. And it was the first step was up to his knee. At this point, she seeks to dissuade him even more, but he's going. Upon this, she repeated her importunity, but to no purpose. And the result was he was taken, arrested according to the dream, and every circumstance of it fulfilled. It really is unusual. But I think sometimes in these periods of time, God does these sometimes extraordinary things. I'm not a charismatic in the technical term that's being used in the 20th century, but I certainly do believe that God does these extraordinary things. I don't believe that God, we don't count on them. We don't make them the heart of the Christian life. But I think there are times that God does them to encourage his people, that he knew all of this beforehand, and he was with Gifford. One gets a medal of Gifford, M-E-T-T-L-E, but from a letter he wrote in 1684. He wrote to a friend named Edward Grant, and Gifford wrote Grant this: "May God give you that grace which will keep you faithful and enable you to do what God does require." Gifford's in prison when he writes this. "And contentedly and cheerfully endure whatever in so doing you may suffer. Your peace of conscience, the welfare of your immortal soul, the pleasure and honor of God is to be preferred before goods, liberty, or life. Consider, God is able to make you stand. His grace is sufficient. His strength is perfect, made perfect in the creature's weakness. Cry to him. Rely on him. Use all the honest means to preserve yourself and to prevent your enemies. Use the wisdom of the serpent, but be sure to keep the innocency of the dove. I had rather that God is pleased to help me abide in prison and in the worst that can be done by my enemies than do the least evil for my deliverance. Pray for me as I pray for you, and so commit you to him who is able to keep you from falling and present you faultless before the presence of his glory with exceeding joy." Should we use illegal means to prevent persecution? In the 20th century, that's come home, I think, in a number of ways. One of them I've thought a lot about is the situation of Dietrich Bonhoeffer, who's sometimes described as a martyr. Bonhoeffer was not an evangelical in some respects. I don't believe he believed in the inerrancy of the Scriptures. But I've no doubt I think that he was a Christian. But I've got problems calling him a martyr because he joins a plot to kill Hitler. As he explained it once, he said, if you're driving in a Volkswagen, that's a Hitler creates the Volkswagen, right? The people's car. And the driver is completely insane, and he's going to kill you and your family in the back seat. What do you do? Well, you got to stop him. And he uses that as an example of Hitler is destroying this nation, and we need to stop him. If that means killing him by assassination, then we have to. And Gifford speaks to that. I just don't think that's an option for the Christian. That, yes, we use all legal means, maybe to avoid being imprisoned, but if that's what it comes to, we have to accept God's providence, his sovereignty, and his lot, and trust he will keep us and honor his witness. The final example is William Mitchell, 1662 to 1705. He was not converted. We know nothing about his early years. He was not converted until 19 years of old. When he was converted, he made plans to become a wealthy businessman. He would later say, I acted the part of a Jonah. He knew God had called him to be a preacher, but he ran. But in God's timing, he brings him back, and he becomes a remarkable preacher. He lived in a part of England. It's called the Pennines. That's in northern England, and it's a row of very, very large hills, maybe mountains. It's as mountainous as England gets. And it separates two major counties, Lancashire on the west side and Yorkshire on the east side. And he was in Lancashire, and he would frequently go over to Yorkshire to preach. What he wanted to do was he wanted to get to the villages in Yorkshire in the morning as people were on their way to work, and he'd stand in the town square to preach. Or he'd want to get there on the beginning of a market day on a Saturday. The only way he could do that easily was he had to travel by night over the Pennines. So this is a range of mountains 4,000, 5,000 feet high. There's no lights. And so he would find himself traversing the Pennines at night easily get lost, completely dark. He would go with his cousin, a man named David Crossley, who would live many years later. And he would, Crossley remembers how they used to cross mile after mile in complete darkness, that they might reach a village in the morning to be able to preach the gospel. He would chiefly, this is Crossley would say of Preachley, Crossley would say of Mitchell, he would set forth the exceeding rich and free grace of the gospel, which toward him had been made so exceeding abundant. We would walk many miles in dark nights over dismal mountains. Many of the crowds that came in here came to mock, came to laugh at him. You know, they're Anglicans. They're in God's church. Who is this man? But many of them would go away, their hearts impacted, and would say, "The Lord is with him of a truth." He was imprisoned in the 1680s. Those who imprisoned him thought they were shutting him up in a dismal dungeon. This is the way he looked on it, though. He wrote to a friend in 1687. He said, "This dungeon, quote, has become for me a paradise because the glorious presence of God is with me and the Spirit of glory and of God rests on me." That's a reference to 1 Peter 4:14, which is right in the middle of a persecution section. "I have been given," he said, "such a glorious sight of God's countenance and the bright splendor of his love, I am willing to suffer affliction with the people of God and for his glorious truth." 1685 came, and somebody told Mitchell, he was in prison, that the king, it was a new king, James II, had issued a declaration of indulgence, and that probably people like him would be released. And Mitchell said this, "Whatever the case about this law, the Lord's will be done. Let him order things that may stand with his glory." And again, these little sentences like that give you a whole mindset. That whatever happens, the most important thing in life ultimately is the glory of God. Whether we be freed, whether we stay here, that God be glorified. This is a remarkable period. It's a period that roots these churches in terms of stability, gives them foundations. There are numbers of these churches that are still around today. I could take you to one in Cork. I go there pretty well every year. We've started a small school to train Baptist leaders and to educate some of the new believers there. It's 40 years ago, the Baptist Church in Cork was the only church in the area, founded in 1649, went through persecution. Today, they've planted 7 works in the last 25, 30 years, 400 baptized believers. That might not sound a lot. That is incredible in Southern Ireland. And many of these churches put down deep, deep roots. It's very interesting. If you want to talk about statistics, 7 Baptist churches in England, all in London, 1644. By 1660, 130. By 1688, that's after nearly 30 years of persecution, close to somewhere between 250 and 300. They doubled. All kinds of stuff today. One of the things I've been telling people, you know, you're talking about church growth. Somebody needs to study this period of church growth. I mean, to go to completely double in a period of 30 years when they're going through massive persecution. Like, there's riches there. Nobody's done it, but somebody needs to do it. And then the final point, the final fruit that is with us today, not only those churches, sadly, many of those churches have died in the 20th century with liberalism coming in. But the one thing that has not died is the books that these men wrote. Many years after John Bunyan was dead, John Newton wrote an introduction to his works and said, "Why would God shut up such a gospel minister for 12 years?" And he said, one of the reasons was that he might pour his spoken speech into written speech. And he's thinking of Pilgrim's Progress. But that's true for all of them. Recently, we have a department of biblical spirituality at the seminary, and we've been talking about some of our programs and lecture courses. And it struck me in the course of our conversation that the Puritan era produced a remarkable body of Christian literature, absolutely almost unparalleled. And part of it, a key part of it, is the persecution these men went through. That's absolutely central in terms of the spiritual riches of that period. I don't always agree with our Puritan forebears, but it is a tremendous body of spiritual literature. Would they have been able to write that if persecution had not been the lot? Let me stop here. We're going to have lunch, right? Can I take time for questions? Is that okay? Maybe take, let's say, 5-10 minutes, depending on how many. Yeah, in 1677, the question was why, you know, the Baptists wrote their what's called the Second London Confession of Faith. And the reason they wrote that was the Second London Confession of Faith is based on the Congregationalist Statement of Faith drawn up by John Owen in 1658, which in turn is based on the Westminster Confession of 1646. And what the Baptists were seeking to do was one thing they were seeking to do in that. There were two or three other things. It was also written against the Quakers. And it was also written because there was a very famous Baptist, Thomas Collier, who had fallen away from the faith. And they wanted to respond to that. But the main reason was they wanted to show to the world that what they believed in the core, their Congregationalist and Presbyterian brothers had also believed. And one of the things that drove that home, they were sharing prison cells with these men. And they started to realize we disagree on issues of church government, but on the core issues of the gospel, we need to stand together. And so the Second London Confession of Faith was an attempt to present a united front against the Anglican Church that was persecuting them. So, thank you.
How would you define Puritanism in the sense of where is the line of demarcation between when or with whom it ends? And I say that because it's like I know what Puritans, who they are, we can name them, but I read a recent biography by Drummond who argued that he believes Spurgeon was the last of the Puritans. So how do we define Puritanism, and when and with whom would you say it ends?
Yeah, so the question is how do we find Puritanism, when does it end? That's a gigundous question. And books have been written on that, and I was involved in a major book on that with about 20 other writers called The Emergence of Evangelicalism. One of the big issues is when does evangelicalism emerge and what is differentiating it from Puritanism? Historically, I mean, I've heard the same thing, you know, Spurgeon the last of the Puritans. The one I've heard is Martin Lloyd-Jones was the last of the Puritans. From an historical standpoint, neither Spurgeon or Lloyd-Jones are Puritan. I mean, chronologically, Puritanism really probably ends around 1700, when by that time, Owen's dead, Richard Baxter's dead, William Kiffin, who's a great Puritan leader, Baptist also, are dead. And you're moving into a different world for a variety of reasons, and evangelicalism emerges 1720s, 1730s. In New England, it's a bit different. New England, Puritanism continues probably into the 1730s, and Jonathan Edwards can be described as a Puritan. Puritanism, what is Puritanism? Puritanism starts as a movement to reform the Church of England. The Church of England is a Protestant church, but the Puritans feel it has not gone far enough. That fails, and it fails when they're all kicked out of the Church of England in 1662. So are the people who come after them Puritan? I think they are, because I think Puritanism at its heart is a renewal movement that is deeply interested in the way in which the Holy Spirit takes the objective work of Christ and applies it to believers and congregations. That's what Puritanism is about. And the core, if you look at what unites these men, they are deeply interested in experiential Christianity, that the truths of the Reformation play out in the life of the believer in every sphere: church, worship, the home, the family, work. I mean, there are three books I recommend, if somebody asks me, three books on marriage. 2 20th century books, and the third one is Richard Baxter's Christian Directory. He's got 150 pages, the duties of husbands to wives and of wives to husbands, and then another 150 pages on children and parents. And the section on husbands and wives is incredible. It's absolutely fabulous. And what is that? It's the Puritan concern that the life in the Spirit occupy the entirety of our lives, that we live our lives to the glory of God. And that's what Puritanism is about. That's true of all genuine Christianity. But I think chronologically, and historians have to make a chronological division, and chronologically, between 1700 and 1730, Puritanism is no longer a movement. It's called The Christian Directory, Richard Baxter, The Christian Directory. It's a big book, and he's got a lot of other stuff in there. Richard Baxter is a great Puritan leader when it comes to the living of the Christian life. He's got some theological oddities. His views on justification are, in certain respects, a bit fuzzy. Yeah. Yeah, the question was where the Amish. The Amish are completely different. The Amish are a Mennonite roots. They come from the Anabaptists. The Anabaptists in the 16th century are those who, I think, rightly protest against the carrying through of the Reformation with the arm of the state. So they're against Luther using German princes to reform the church. Calvin is not completely where Luther is, but he still sees church and state like this. And that's why Calvin does not disagree with the burning of Michael Servetus, who is an Anabaptist. He's a theologically errant Anabaptist. He's a Unitarian Anabaptist. Among the early Anabaptists are the Mennonites. And the Mennonites go on a long trek during the 17th and 18th century. They move from Holland because of persecution to Russia, and then a lot of them from Russia during the 19th century because of pogroms and attacks on them, they move to Paraguay, Uruguay maybe, and then also Mexico. And from Mexico, a lot of them come up to Canada and the United States. Or some of them come directly from Europe over to Pennsylvania. And the Amish are a particular branch of the Mennonites who have the conviction that their life, their clothing, et cetera, it can't go beyond, I think it's 1800 or something like that. So they don't wear zippers, right? On your pants. Zippers are invented 1830s, 1840s, maybe a bit later. So I have a lot of respect for them in terms of their communities. As a gospel people, they're frozen in the past, and they may encourage our respect, but I don't think they're helping furthering the gospel. We're called to live in the early 21st century. I'm a historian. If you ask me what was the time period I'd love to have lived in, to be honest, it would be the 1770s through to about the 1830s. I just love that period. I love the men that were there, the men like Carey and Fuller. I mean, I read those men's writings and I resonate. I wasn't born then. I gotta live now. So it wouldn't help me going around wearing clothing from 1700. I mean, if I'd come in here today with a wig on, I mean, you'd be wondering what you'd stepped into. Is this some sort of historical reenactment, or so we treasure history. It has riches to teach us, but we're not antiquarians. We don't live there. And as a historian, I love history for two reasons. Number one, I love history. But I'm a Christian. And I do history for the church. And that means trying to show how the riches of the past can help give us wisdom for the present. And the Amish, I think, they're just living in the past. So, any one last question, and then we'll break for lunch. Yeah, so the question was the requirement for the Book of Common Prayer in that period linked to the whole understanding of the church, of the infant receiving the Spirit at baptism? It is to some degree. From the Anglican church's point of view, becoming an Anglican when you're a baby is also becoming an Englishman. Your citizenship is bound up with your church identity. The Church of England is the state church. It has the arm of the state to support it and enforce it. And if you refuse to become an Anglican, you're now a second-class citizen. You're not really English. And, I mean, I've spent enough time in England today to know that it's still there. All of the... It's very rare among the aristocracy or the powers that be that you don't have some Anglican connection. It's very rare. There is one aristocratic family, the Duke and Duchess of Norfolk, who have been Catholic all the way back. Their distant ancestor is Catherine Howard, the fifth wife of Henry VIII. But that is very rare. Princess Michael of Kent, that's a woman, despite her name. She recently became a Catholic, and that was horrifying. Tony Blair is a Catholic, and that was very unusual. Anglicanism is just part of the ruling class in England. And if you're Baptist, you're cutting yourself off from that. And so, yeah, it is linked to that, very much linked to that. And it's part of the stratification of society. That's tied up with it. That's tied up with it. But it's not that's the problem that the Anglicans have with Baptists. But the problem they have with Puritans, a lot of the Puritans baptize infants. But that is definitely tied up with that whole area there. I mean, that nearly happened here in parts of the United States. In Virginia, I'm not going to touch on this. In Virginia, in the 18th century, the state church was Anglicanism, and our Baptist forebears went through horrors. In Virginia, imprisonment and persecution, brutal persecution. I'll give you one little anecdote, and then we'll have to break for lunch. Robert E. Lee's aunt, and I forget her. Her last name was Lee. She was raised Anglican, and she was converted at a separate Baptist meeting. Very wealthy. She was part of, if you ever go to Virginia, Stratford Hall, my wife and I went there about 2 years ago. You actually stay on the grounds. It's gorgeous. That's the ancestral home of Robert E. Lee. When she was converted, she had lived a bit of a wild life before her conversion. Her family still accepted her, even while she lived a wild life. She basically lived with a man that she didn't marry. When she got converted, they basically cut her off and became a Baptist. And so that nearly happened in parts of the states. Massachusetts and Connecticut, again, the whole idea of the state church there. Anyway, so we need to break. Thank you.
Thank you, Michael. We've come to our lunch break, and so this is free time in the Austin area. There's a lot of food still left over in the fellowship hall, and so if you want to stay and eat up food during the lunch break, you're welcome to do that. There's also area restaurants. If you need ideas, people around you can help you out, and we're going to gather back here at 2:30. So at